Our study today comes from John chapter 13. And last week we left off at verse 20. So let's pick it up in verse 21 and read it to the end. When Yeshua had said this, he became troubled in spirit. By the way, this is the third time in the Gospel of John it speaks of Yeshua being troubled. And testified and said, "Truly, truly, I say to you that one of you will betray me." The disciples began looking at one another at a loss to know of which one he was speaking. There was reclining on Yeshua's breast one of his disciples, whom Yeshua loved. Simon Peter therefore gestured to him and said to him, "Tell us who it is of whom he is speaking." He, leaning back thus on Yeshua's breast, said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Yeshua therefore answered, "That is the one for whom I shall dip the morsel and give it to him." So when he had dipped the morsel, he took and gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And after the morsel, Satan then entered into him. Yeshua therefore said to him, "What you do, do quickly." Now no one of those reclining at the table knew for what purpose he had said this to him. For some were supposing because Judas had the money box that Yeshua was saying to him, "Buy the things we need for the feast," or else that he should give something to the poor. And so after receiving the morsel, he went out immediately, and it was night. When therefore he had gone out, Yeshua said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and will glorify him immediately. Little children, I am with you a little while longer. You shall seek me, and as I said to the Jews, I now say to you also, where I am going, you cannot come. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Yeshua answered, "Where I go, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow later." Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you." Yeshua answered, "Will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, a cock shall not crow until you deny me three times." To get a mental picture of what was going on in this upper room, it refers to the disciples and Yeshua reclining at table. And typically at that time, the whole ancient world at that time had adopted this seating arrangement when having some kind of a banquet. They would have a table set up in a U-shaped form. It might be three platforms that are suspended a little bit off the ground, maybe 6 to 10 inches off the floor. And then the individuals would recline. So these lines here represent individuals reclining at the table. Now the person who is in charge, who would be Yeshua, would be reclining right in the middle. And those who were being honored by him would recline on either side. And when they would recline, they would always recline on the left side so they could eat with the right hand. So they support themselves on their left elbow. There'd be cushions there, and then they would eat with the right. But we've talked before about how in Middle Eastern thought, in Jewish thought, the left side is the side of the flesh. The right side is the side of righteousness and spirituality. It doesn't mean the left side is evil. It just means it's the fleshly side. We all have flesh, okay? That's not a bad thing. So when you walk in the flesh, it's bad. And this is one of the reasons why Yeshua says, "You do your alms, don't do it to be seen as men, and don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing." In other words, good deeds are always seen to be done with the right. And he's saying, keep the flesh out of it when you're doing good deeds. Don't let the left know what's going on. And we've looked at the map of Israel and seen how the right side of Israel, when you have the map situated correctly, and the left side of Israel teach these same truths. And but that's another subject we can get into at another time. So we see Yeshua in the middle, and it says that John is next to him, and John could lean back and speak to Yeshua. So which side is John on? He's on the right side, isn't he? And it would seem that Judas was on the left side, because Yeshua could reach for a piece of bread and just hand it directly to him. And tradition has it that Judas is on his left side. Now, whether that's fact or not, we're not quite sure, but we're going to put him there because these two characters play an important part. They both have intimate discussion with Yeshua. So we're going to assume that Judas is on the left, but we do know that John is on the right. And then we'd have five more disciples out here. And somewhere in the mix is Peter. Now, this arrangement can bear quite a bit of study. There's a lot of insight here. Because every single one of us, I'll put Peter here, because we don't know where he's sitting. He could be on the left, right side, but one of these. Every one of us has the potential within us to be a Judas or to be a John. And all of us, by nature, are kind of a Peter. Peter is a man of many words. He's a man of action. He couldn't sit still. And he's a man of failure over and over and over again. And as we said last week, you know, so many people say, I really identify with Peter. Well, you should, because he's pretty typical of most people. In fact, you could make all 10 of these people out here kind of Peter-like. But there's some people who don't just deny the Lord, they betray him. These are rare. And there's some people on the opposite extreme who stand in faith constantly. Because John is the one who Yeshua honored by placing him on the right. It was John, the only disciple who did not flee the crucifixion scene, who stood there, who stood his ground. John was the only one of the disciples who died of old age. All the rest died as martyrs. And it was John, and I believe it's because of his faithfulness, because of his heart, because there's a quality about him, that he's the one who's referred to throughout the Gospels, the disciple whom Yeshua loved. And we know Yeshua loved them all, but John had a special place in Yeshua's heart. And when she was on the cross, he looks down at his mother Mary, and there's his faithful disciple John, the only disciple there who didn't run away in fear. And he speaks to his mother and says, "Woman, behold your son." And then he looks to John and says, "Behold your mother." In other words, Yeshua says, I'm going away, but John, you're going to stand in for me. You're going to be a son to my mother from now on. What an honor. What an incredible honor. And you know, Yeshua would like every one of us to stand in for him. As he is gone now, he wants each of us to stand in, to be the one to protect the weak, to take care and provide for others, to be his representative on earth. You follow what I'm saying? So we see Judas who betrayed. We see Peter who denied. Oh, old Peter. You know, we all deny Yeshua. We all do. It's kind of like this. It's like a balloon. You ever have a balloon? You squeeze one end, what happens to the other end? It gets bigger. You squeeze that end, then the first end gets bigger. And you see, your faithfulness to Yeshua is going to cost you something. But on the other hand, your pursuit of the world is also going to cost you something. And if you pursue the world, what it will cost you is your closeness and intimacy with Yeshua. But if you pursue intimacy with Yeshua, it's going to cost you all the things, or many of the things, the world has to offer. You can pursue the one, or you can pursue the other. And to the degree you pursue the world, to that degree you are denying Yeshua. To that degree. Because what was Peter's motive for denying Yeshua? Fear. Fear. When he's in Yeshua's presence, I'll die for you, I'll lay down my life for you, I'll never deny you, I'll follow you, and Yeshua says, listen, before the cock crows, you'll deny me not once, not twice, three times. You're so fearful and weak, Peter. When you're with me, you feel great strength, but the moment you're out of my sight, or I'm out of yours, then all of a sudden the world gets big to you. The world becomes important, and you become fearful about standing against this world and standing for me. Yeshua did it, Peter did eventually lay down his life for the Lord, but that's another story. And you know, it's interesting to see Yeshua in the middle of these two extremes, John on the one hand, Judas on the other. When we see Yeshua on the cross, He was between two extremes. There were two criminals crucified, weren't there? One on either side. One on one side mocked him. The one on the other expressed faith in him. And we know when Yeshua comes back as judge, he'll once again stand between two extremes. And he'll divide the nations. He'll judge the nations. And the goats will go to one side and the sheep to the other. He's a sword, isn't he? He's the Word made flesh. And the Word of God is living and sharper than a two-edged sword, dividing asunder. And Yeshua, the truth, has a way of dividing. And we see that happening here. Now we're going to come back to this scene in a moment, but we're going to take a detour. I'm constantly amazed as how I study and prepare for teaching on Saturdays. God brings into my path certain things that are exactly what I need to prepare the teaching. And this week has been no different. Carla, a few weeks ago, emailed me a message by Rabbi Akiva Tetz, the author of Living Inspired, which we have in our library here. And in this email, it's got about an hour-long message with a little video. You can actually see him teaching if you want. I can send that to you, or you can look for it on your internet provider. I can tell you how to do that later. And this message by Akiva Tetz, I didn't realize it at first, because I began to study this. It was exactly what we need to open up this chapter to us. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take just the essentials of his message, his teaching, and share those with you. And you're going to be thinking, what does this have to do with the upper room and Judas and John and Yeshua and the Last Supper? And what does this have to do with anything? Hold on, and you'll see. And while I go through this, I'd like you to do me a favor. I'd like you to, if you have questions or comments, just to jot them down so you don't forget them. Your comments and questions are important to me. They're very helpful to us as a group, and I want them. But I want to ask you to let me get through this, and then I'll pause. We'll have some time for some discussions and questions. And then we'll go on and we'll look at the application of what's going on here. Okay? The talk that Rabbi Tetz gave was called The Hidden Power of Speech. The Hidden Power of Speech. And he started off his message by discussing how the Word tells us that we are created in the image of God. The Zelem of God is the Word. Doesn't mean we look like Him. God does not have a physical form. We don't look like Him physically. But our bodies represent the truth of who God is. And if every part, if any part of the body can truly be studied and observed objectively, if we can look at a part of the body, I don't care whether it's something as small as a cell, something as large as your leg, it doesn't make any difference. You look at any detail or any system, any organ, and objectively study how it operates, where it's located, how it works, what it accomplishes, you will learn truth about God. And that's what our bodies were given to teach us. And so what we want to look at is the organ of speech. First of all, speech is a really kind of an odd thing. It's a very, very strange and odd thing. What it allows us to do is to connect with each other. I can take an idea. This idea may come from the devil. It may come from God. It may come from a TV show. It could come from anything. But I have a concept in my mind. That concept is hidden, and it's invisible. And I take that concept, and I can't give you that thing that I have. I cannot give it to you. But what I can try to do is try to package bits of it in words. And I send those words across space, and you pick them up with your ears, and then you reassemble the packages, and hopefully, somehow in your mind, you have something close to what's in mine. Now, you can never completely give the concept away, but we can come pretty close. And that's a bizarre thing. God did not have to use speech as a way of us to communicate with each other. He could have invented something else where he could look in each other's eyes and zip, it's like downloading an idea so you have an exact copy of what's in my mind. But he didn't do that. He made us go through the thing of speech, which takes time, which takes effort. It can be done well. It can be done poorly. It also allows confusion to interfere. And in many ways, speech has its limitations, but it is the method which God has chosen for us to communicate with one another. And speech is found in the neck. The sages teach that the origin of speech is here in the throat, not the mouth. The origin is in here in the throat, in the neck. And just as speech is used to connect, and God speaks from the invisible world into the physical world. Isn't that how creation came about? God spoke from the spiritual, and he spoke, and through his speech, the world came into being. Speech connects the higher world with the lower world. And what does your neck do? It connects the higher world, your head, with the lower world. When Paul writes in Corinthians, and he describes the relationship of the redeemed community to the Messiah, what does he say? He says, you are the body of Messiah. He's the head. You're the body. He's the upper world. You're the lower world. It's in the head where the brain exists. Sight, hearing, smell, taste, and feeling all exist in the head. That's our Messiah. But down here, what senses do we have? Just feelings. Just feelings. That's all we have. Just feelings. This is why we're so prone to error. Because the head speaks clearly to us. This is the way you are to walk. These are my commandments. These are what you're to do. We say, well, I don't see that. I don't get that. That's not what I see, Lord. It's because the eyeballs are in the upper world. The eyeballs are in the higher world. But I connect with you through speech. Now, you can either trust me, and it'll be accounted to you as righteousness, or you can disobey me. But the neck is the place where speech originates, because it's the connection between higher and lower worlds. Now, speech is articulated through the mouth, of course. And the mouth can speak to the lower worlds, just as God spoke this world into existence, as he speaks it to us through his word. But how do we speak to him? We speak to him with groanings that cannot be uttered. And the Holy Spirit comes alongside to help us express these things. And what's interesting is when Paul in Romans talks about how we pray with groanings that cannot be uttered, that was not an original thought with him. That was an ancient thought that is found in the ancient writings of Israel, which talks about how when he comes before God, if we use words, they're generally words that he's given us. But deep inside of us, there are these words, there are these groanings that we don't know how to express. And they just come out like the letter hey. Isn't that interesting that in the lungs, that's where the air comes? So how do we express ourselves to God? We just pour ourselves out to him. We have such a hard time articulating our thoughts, articulating our feelings, our expressions. But he's faithful. He's so faithful to hear them anyway. But it's in the head, at the mouth, where speech is expressed. Now, I want us to look at the mouth, because this is where it plays into our story. The rabbis write that the mouth does three things. There are three things the mouth does. What's the first one? I know all the guys have this one on their mind, which is what? Eating, right. The mouth is involved with eating. The mouth is also involved with speaking. And the rabbis say there's a third thing that the mouth is used for, and that's kissing. And the rabbis teach, and this is a very Jewish principle, very scriptural principle, that if there's a thing, a word or a thing that has two or more uses, or two or more functions, that all of those functions are one. They are all one. And so all of these are one. They're all one thing. They are all ways to connect. And the mouth is the organ. It's the facility with which God's endowed us to connect. Let's start with the first one, eating. By eating, this is how energy is brought into us that connects our souls with our bodies and keeps our souls and bodies attached to each other. If you quit eating, what's going to happen? Eventually, your soul is going to depart from your body. Now, sometimes we fast, don't we? We don't eat for a period of time. Why is that? What's the value in that? By fasting, we allow the soul to become distracted with spiritual things. You understand? We kind of loosen the reins on the soul so the soul can draw a little more closely to the Lord. Fasting is a valuable thing, and it's something that I don't think is practiced enough. I know in my life it isn't. I fast between meals, but I don't think that's quite good enough. Sometimes. And this also brings up another important thing. When you think of the importance of the mouth and eating and the food, and the food, the energy there is what attaches and keeps our souls attached to our bodies, is it any wonder why the Word commands us to eat only clean foods? God does not want us to eat those things that are unclean, because He does not want our souls attached to our bodies by means of unclean energy. Now, once again, you say, well, I don't see that. I like pork and shrimp, and I don't see any damage. Yeah, but you're the body. You don't have eyes. You don't have ears. You don't have a brain, spiritually speaking. We must take our orders from the Lord. And that's why so many people, and you've heard us hear testimonies by people in the fellowship, that when they began to experiment with kosher eating, they began to discover changes in the way they thought. Lust fell off. Distraction with pornography fell by the wayside. It just kind of died off. Thought life changed. Why is that? The energy by which you're connecting your soul, attaching your soul to your body, is now a clean one. Okay? God knows what He's talking about when He tells us, these things, these meats are abominations to me. They are unclean. Do not put them in your bodies. These things are clean. These things you can eat. Speaking. Now, eating is how the soul is attached to the body, but speaking is how you can attach to another person. It's a connection between you and another. Okay? If you could not express yourself, communicate with another, you could have no connection with them, really. And then kissing. What a bizarre thing that is. Really, when you think about these objectively, all three are pretty bizarre when you think about it. But kissing, it's universal. It's found in all cultures. Rabbi Tass was saying, you know, if some Martian or something came to Earth and you ask this person, how do you think these human beings will express affection to one another? You know, maybe they'll put their foreheads together, or they'll shake hands. I mean, that makes sense, or whatever. But put their mouths together? But you see, kissing is the most intimate of the three. It transcends speech. In fact, when you're kissing someone, you can't talk. And there's no need to. Kissing expresses the very emotions and energies of the Spirit itself. Eating is very physical. Speaking is very soulish. But kissing, although it's a physical thing, if it's done between true friends, true husband and wife, then it's something that's extremely intimate. Whether it's kissing on the lips or kissing on the cheek. About five times in the New Testament, we're told to greet one another with a holy kiss. I remember as teenagers, we really liked that verse. We didn't like the holy part, but we tended to kind of overlook that. But with a holy kiss, because there should be that expression of intimacy and of connection. You see how the mouth is the organ by which we connect? You begin to see that? And you see that the lower worlds and upper worlds are connected through the neck, which is the origin of speech. It was not for speech, for words, for language. How could we know God? He has left us with words. As by means of these words that we come into His presence, by means of these words we learn about Him. You see, when you receive, if you want to receive Yeshua, what you do is you receive His words. You receive Yeshua. When you study His words, that's how you demonstrate devotion to Yeshua. And when you obey His words, that's how you show love for Yeshua. Because after all, Yeshua is the Word made flesh. So there's no such thing as embracing Yeshua apart from His message and His words. It's impossible. Can't be done. If you try, that's called hypocrisy. All right? I try it. We've all tried that. But His words, we must treat those, because that is the essence of who Yeshua is Himself. That's why He says, here in the next couple of chapters of John, it's imperative for you that I go away. Because if I go away, then I'll send the Comforter. And what will he do? He'll lead you into all truth. He'll teach you all things. He'll remind you of the things I said. And that's more important than me being here physically. Now, there's so much more we could go into upon this subject. But I encourage you to listen to the teaching yourself. Because I'm doing a poor and inadequate job in a few minutes of what he does so well and so I can't even think of a word to describe what I'm trying to say. Profoundly, yes, and skillfully expresses these things. Now, let's just get us back to Judas for a moment. How did Judas die? He hanged himself. Think about that for a moment. Out of all the ways he could have killed himself, he put the noose around his neck and he cuts off the upper world from the lower world. But then Peter, in the first chapter of Acts, gives us a few more details. He says also that he fell and that his intestines gushed out. You see, whenever you break the power of speech, you destroy the lower world. Whenever you misuse speech, you bring destruction. Whenever you cut off the upper from the lower worlds with your speech, you bring destruction to this world. This is what's so important. It's so important that, you know what the sages compare words to? They compare words to seed. You know, the word talks about circumcision of the flesh. It also talks about circumcision of the lips. And just as the Bible puts a very, very, very serious prohibition upon the spilling of seed, it puts a serious prohibition upon the wasting of words. Not just lies. We're not talking about the misuse of words. Just empty words. Just talk for the sake of talk. And just as through human seed, you bring physical children into the world, through your words, you bring students into the world. You understand what I'm saying? Through physical seed, you make sons, but through your words, you make students. And in Jewish thought, a young man has a greater dedication, devotion to his Torah teacher than to his physical father. Because my father gave me my body, but my Torah teacher gives me my soul. Now, if the father pays for his Torah education, then he's got both bases covered. Because according to tradition, if a young man sees his father in need and he sees a Torah teacher in need, he must go to his Torah teacher first. But if his father is the one who's paying for his education, he goes to his father first. But you produce spiritual sons through words. This is why Paul writes to Timothy, 1 Timothy 1:2. He refers to Timothy as my son in the faith, not my son in the flesh. But he's my son in the faith because it's through me, but through my words, my teaching, my discipleship, I've made Timothy a disciple, a student. And now he's out there being a light to the world. And he's carrying out the message I'm carrying. Do you see that picture? The spilling of seed, the spilling of words are both very, very serious offenses. In fact, when you look at 1 Samuel, it talks about Samuel. And as he grew up, it says not one of his words fell to the ground. You see the imagery there? Not one of his words fell to the ground. Not one was wasted. His words were filled with life. He used the power of speech for all it was intended to be used for. It was not wasted. But when you misuse speech, you bring destruction. You see, the rabbis teach that the definition of goodness is this. Goodness is when you use a tool or a thing for that which it was designed to be used for. When you use a thing for that which is designed. For example, here's a microphone. If I use that microphone for what it's meant to be used for, it's a good thing. But if I use that microphone to drive nails into the wall, the microphone's destroyed, the nails don't get driven into the wall, and there's destruction. Your words are powerful, and they are meant to bring life. Yeshua says, my words are spirit and life. Ours are to be the same. We're not even talking about lying here. That's not, in the Jewish definition, it's not even speech at all. It's a perversion of speech. It's not true speech. Real speech is when you speak the truth. That's true Lashon Hara. When you speak the truth to do damage, because that is so much more powerful. If I tell a lie about you, that lie can be disproved. But if I speak the truth about you in a way that's damaging, that is such a powerful thing and a more wicked and evil thing than lying. You follow what I'm saying? So we could talk much more about this. I want to take a break on this. I want you to see, I want you to get these concepts in mind as we then go back to the Gospel of John and look at some things. Are there any questions or insights that you want to share at this point? Yes, Jennifer.
Okay, but I learned from
Adolf Hitler, you're absolutely right. He is such an effective speaker. But he was inspired by who? The serpent. And what does the serpent have? What's his one weapon? Mouth. The mouth. He's a liar from the beginning. That's his only weapon. That's the only weapon the enemy has. You've heard me harp on this before, and it's worth harping on many times to come. The only weapon the enemy has is a mouth. That's all he's got. The only weapon he's got is the lie. And our weapons are far superior. Far superior to his. The one thing that Satan fears above all else is a believer who knows how to use his armor and his weapons, because the enemy has nothing, not a thing he can do to defend himself. There's not one chink he can find to get in his lies. But boy, if we believe his lies for one moment, then we're under his power. The only time the name Satan is used in the Gospel of John, the only time, it's found one time the Gospel of John is right here, is when Judas goes to betray him. Yeshua passes the bread over to Judas. He eats it and says, then Satan entered him. So only use that one time. Because I don't think Judas could have done what he did on his own. What he did was so wicked, so evil, it could only be done by the inspiration and empowerment of Satan himself. And just as the only way John could have done what he did to stand so courageously all his life was through the help of the Holy Spirit. The only way Judas could have done what he did was through the aid of the serpent. Jim.
When the question was asked Yeshua, who was the deceiver, why did he not use words then but said, who I give this sop to?
Ah, we're going to get to that. See, you're thinking ahead. That's exactly what we're going to get to, Jim. Anya?
Is there a connection to all the things that have spoken in Isaiah, also the angel that
he had unclean lips, and he touched the coal of the... Ah, I'm sure there is. When Isaiah told the angel he was a man of unclean lips, and the coal was brought, touched his lips. I'm repeating your question for the sake of the tape. I'm trying to be good. I keep telling, have people tell me, repeat the question. I'm sure there is a connection there. I haven't really thought that through, but I'm absolutely sure there is. There has to be. Joan?
When you read this part, this verse 33 just left out, and I'm like, what on earth? He calls them little children, and he says, you shall seek me, and as I said to the Jews, I'm like, who's he talking about there? These people, they were Jews. So I'm like, okay, and then a mystery uncovered.
Well, I think we can answer that. And why does he say, as I spoke to the Jews? This is the last gospel that was written. This was written many decades after the other gospels. This is written after the book of Revelation. And that by that time, the word Jews had taken on a slightly different connotation, and so John is simply using that connotation. And the other references he's speaking of are found earlier. You may remember them when Yeshua started going away, and at one point the Jews said, oh, where is he going? Is he going among the Gentiles? Another time he said he's going away, they said, oh, what's he going to do, kill himself? Okay? And this time he says, and I'm telling you this way, I told them, I am going away, and you can't follow me. You don't know where I'm going, you can't follow me right now, but you will later on. But the topic of how John uses the word or the phrase the Jews is one that books have been written about, and it is a topic of study. But it's the main difference is that John's gospel is written much later, and it was written mostly to Gentiles, and the way the word the Jews is used is in a slightly different connotation. And so he uses that connotation here. That's all. Vern, you have your hand up. Yes.
Four quick points.
Okay.
In the table setting, in the inner circle has Peter, James, and John. So I was wondering about James.
Mm-hmm.
In the fasting, they have the word breakfast.
Yes, right.
But Ramadan, they fast the whole day, but then they splurge during the night.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Eskimos rub their noses when they curse.
Yeah, just when their lips are wet, they rub their noses. That's right. They'll stick together.
And then the panel is being given by the Torah teacher in Jewish mythology. So there's a gulf in the eternal realm that comes down to the baby, the soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I say that the Torah teacher gives him a soul, basically I'm saying he brings that soul into development. It's like, where do you get your mind? Are you born with it, or is it something that's trained by a teacher? Well, there are arguments for both. Just as your body, you are what you eat, mentally, you are what you study, and what you allow your mind to dwell on. And so a Torah teacher is going to guide your mind into those things that you're going to form your mind into something that's strong, and something that's right, and righteous, and pure. Yeah. So, there's one of your points I was going to address. Oh, yeah, some cultures, I've heard before, I'm not sure where, if it's in Africa or Far East, but some cultures, you ask them, where does the human soul dwell? They won't say, well, in the heart or in the head. They say it dwells in the throat. Isn't that interesting? And the Hebrew word for soul, neshama, is the same word used for neshama, which means breath. Isn't that interesting? The soul and the breath. Because how do you express your soul? Through speech. How did your soul come into you? It was breathed in by God. Okay? He breathed into him the neshama of life. Okay? And man became a living being. You know, we talk more about the neck. Hebrew is such a fascinating subject. But in some of the mystical writings in Hebrew, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our teacher, is referred to as the throat of God. The throat of God. They refer to the throat as being a picture of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because it's through Moses God spoke down to this world. He gave us the Torah. It's through Moses also, Moses interceded for the Israelites. He spoke to God. But what is the back of the neck called? You know what the back of the neck is called? The Hebrew word for the nape of the neck is the word orif. Ayin resh peh. And orif, if you turn the word around, is spelled paro, pharaoh. Isn't that amazing? So everything towards the front. Now here's another thing about the human body. Everything towards the front is to reveal, to express. Right? When you talk to someone, you don't stand back to back and talk. You turn face to face and talk. And in Numbers chapter 12, I believe, God says, I don't speak to Moses the way I speak to others. I spoke to him, pay le pay, mouth to mouth. It's almost as if there was a holy kiss there. And it's that intimacy that Moses and God enjoyed. And you have to understand it's in pure language, not in sexual language, but in pure language. There's an intimacy there God's trying to describe in physical terms that I could actually take my thoughts and put them into Moses. It went beyond speech. The sages say, what was the speech impediment Moses had? And I say, oh, maybe he had a stutter, or maybe he had a tooth broken out, or he had wounded himself, or something or other. And I say what it is that his relations with God was so intimate and deep, he could get the very thoughts of God themselves, but he couldn't package them into words. It was just, how do you put this into words? How do you put it into words? So maybe that was the difficulty, I don't know. But the human body, how fascinating. The front is the light and the expression, but the back is darkness. And Moses asked to see God's glory. And God said, I'll make all my goodness pass before you. And God expressed his goodness, he expressed his front through speech. But the only part Moses allowed to actually see was the backside. That's why we're told to seek his face. You know what the face of God is? Yeshua is the face of God. And as we seek Yeshua, we begin to see God in a whole new way, a whole different way. But this is another subject too. Paul?
Do you think that since Judas joined between one of the 12 disciples, you think in the beginning he followed Jesus and then decided, well, he's just afraid of him like who he is, and next thing he decided to betray him? Or was there some sort of point that he decided that, you know, I don't want to follow him anymore, but I'm not going to tell anyone else, but I don't think anyone else knew what he was thinking.
I think Judas was kind of a scoundrel from the beginning, personally. That's my thought. Just kind of what I pick up on what's expressed. Turn to Matthew for a moment. Yeah, did Judas turn bad, or was he kind of bad from the beginning? I think he's kind of bad from the beginning. He wasn't fully committed from the beginning.
No possibility he could have been a believer.
No, he was a believer. Yeah. Oh, he's a believer. But so are the demons.
I mean, a believer by...
But he was not obedient, no. No, he was not obedient. The demons believe. And so if you're a believer, okay, great, you're at the same level as the demonic. Now, are you going to obey him? No, that's different. Because if you love him, then you'll obey his commandments. This is something Judas did, and we're told that Judas was a thief. He kept the money bag and dipped it into it for himself. And Judas is up for himself. He used Yeshua for his own advancement, and as a result, lost everything.
I put it the other way. Had he asked for forgiveness, would he have been forgiven?
Absolutely. If he had been repentant. Asking forgiveness without repentance is an empty exercise. The Talmud says that a person who asks for forgiveness, confesses his sins without repenting, it's like one who takes a dead lizard, which makes him unclean, and then goes into the mikvah to get clean, but still holds on to the dead lizard. He goes in the mikvah and comes out, and he's still dirty. You have to let go of the dead lizard. Then you enter the mikvah, then you're cleansed. And so I think a lot of people kind of go into confession with dead lizards in their hands. They're still unclean. They're unrepentant. But there's a passage here in Matthew. Let me see if I can put my finger on it right away. I thought I had it marked down here. Let's see. Oh, here we go. Matthew 26. I want you to make a comparison here between Judas and the other disciples. Matthew 26, verse 14. Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests. They didn't come to him, he went to them. This was his idea. And said, what are you willing to give me to deliver him up to you? What will you offer me? I'm willing to give him up. What will you give me, though? It's going to cost you. What are you willing to pay? And they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver. And from then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray him. Now, compare that with the next verse. Now, on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Yeshua saying, where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? See the difference in the questions? Judas says to the priest, what will you give me for me to sell him to you? The disciples go to Yeshua and say, what do you want us to do for you? Judas wanted something done for himself. He's willing to sell Yeshua to do it. You know, the spirit of Judas is still alive and well. And maybe all of us at some time, or some of us, at some time or other, have used Yeshua and sold him out to some degree or another for personal gain. Maybe not, but it's something to seriously think about. But you see how the heart of Judas is different from the hearts of the other disciples? They wanted to please Yeshua. Judas wanted to use Yeshua to please himself. He's willing to sell him if the price is right. Robin, your hand is up first. Yeah, he lost everything. Yes. Good point, yes. Everything Judas tried to gain, he lost. He wanted the silver, he turns out throwing that down the temple. He wanted apparently some kind of rank security, he lost that. He lost his life, he lost his Messiah, he lost everything. He lost his discipleship. John, on the other hand, didn't try to hang on to anything. And he gained everything. He gained the world. Yeah, Brian, your hand is up.
One thing important to also remember about Judas, in light of the fact that I agree he was always a scoundrel from the beginning, he nevertheless, according to Matthew chapter 10, was among the 12 endowed with the ability to cast out evil spirits, to heal the sick,
right,
to raise the dead. To do all the things that all the 12
did, exactly,
which is 12, not the 11. Jesus gave that authority too.
Exactly. Excellent insight. Judas is empowered with the same gifts and empowerments as the other disciples. Now, there's an important lesson here to learn. Just because someone demonstrates spiritual power does not mean that they are a disciple of the Lord. Don't ever let power sidetrack you from looking into a person's heart. And in fact, Moses prophesied that there would come prophets who would work miracles. He says, I don't care about the miracles. If they lead you astray to other gods, stone them. I don't care how many miracles they work. You stone them because they're not for me. He said, I'll send them among you to test you. So I tell you, people in their immaturity are in a very dangerous position when they follow other men or women because they demonstrate spiritual power. That is no proof that they're of God. None whatsoever. Yeah,
and
Brian, go
ahead. Observation too is that from all evidence there in Matthew chapter 26, Jesus did announce that one of them would betray him. No one suspected Judas.
No, no one did.
But he had so successfully masqueraded as a spiritual man, a disciple of the rest of them, that the disciples all ended up responding, Lord,
is it I? Exactly.
Well, I suspected Judas from the beginning.
Yeah, no one suspected him. I don't think so. I don't know. Yeah. I know, it's a good question, Ruth. I don't know. Did Judas realize himself what a treacherous person he was? I don't know. Absolutely. Would have been before. Yeah, apparently the noose broke or... Yeah. Yeah, he hanged himself and then apparently the rope broke or whatever and then he fell forward and... Yeah. The head wasn't damaged, just below the neck. Well, let's bring this to a conclusion. Let me ask you this. Judas had a message to communicate to the mob, these people who came with him to arrest Yeshua. And he had a premeditated sign. We won't even take the time to look up the passage right now, but you all know what it was. How was he to indicate to the mob who Yeshua was? What was it? What was the sign? A kiss. And now we come back to John 13 and Jim's question earlier. Yeshua says there that one of them is going to betray me. Peter gestures to John, because John's right there in front of Yeshua. John, ask him which one of us it is. So John leans back onto Yeshua's chest and gets real close and says, now who is it? Lord, who is it? So Yeshua says, I'm going to indicate to my 11 disciples who the betrayer is. He didn't just point to Judas and say, oh, it's this guy next to me. He says, I'm going to give you a sign to indicate who the betrayer is. And he says, that is the one for whom I shall dip the morsel and give it to him to eat. Okay? Mm-hmm. It would seem so. Yeah, just for John to hear. Judas indicates who Yeshua is by a kiss. Yeshua indicates who the betrayer is by eating. But where is the speech? Where is the speech? Where is the place where Judas and Yeshua speak to each other? Well, that is found over in Matthew chapter 26. Matthew 26. We were just there a moment ago, weren't we? Go to Matthew chapter 26 and verse 25. And Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, surely it is not I, Rabbi. He said to him, you have said it yourself. You have said it yourself. We started off a discussion talking about how the mouth is the organ of connection. It's the means of connecting through eating, through speech, through kissing. And we see all three of those used here. We see one of them, the most intimate, the highest of them all, grossly misused in such a sinful and terrible way by Judas. Yet Yeshua uses speech and uses food in a way to serve him. It's almost like, Judas, I know what you're going to do, but I love you so much, and I know there's no avoiding what's to be done here. So here, let this strengthen you. Here's some food. Here's your food, anyway. I'm not going to withhold food from you, but I know even what you do in your treachery, in your sin, in your betrayal, is still not as big as my Father's sovereignty, and he will take this and turn it to my glory. So here, eat. And then Satan entered into him. You know, I want to go back to speech and close with this. Because we see Judas leave at that point in John. We can go back to John again. We'll finish there. We see Judas leave the scene. And then through the rest of chapter 13, all of 14, all of 15, all of 16, all of 17, Yeshua is talking. He's talking, he's pouring out his heart. Because he's wanting to say goodbye to his disciples, so to speak. And he wants to lay out for them all these things that have filled his heart. He wants to share all these things with them. And then in chapter 18, we immediately see Judas come back on the scene again, and Yeshua is quiet. But during this interval that Judas is out of the way, we see Yeshua speak. And you know what Yeshua speaks about in chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, 17? Connection, oneness. It's really an incredible thing to look at. We won't read all four chapters. You're going to be doing that over the next few weeks. But look at some of these passages. I'm just going to give you some passages, and I'll read them aloud, and you can write down the references yourself, but better yet, read all these on your own, and you can see all the ones I've read and the ones I'm omitting. But we'll start with 13. 34, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my Talmidim, my students, if you have love one for another. In chapter 14, verse 20, in that day you shall know that I am in my Father and you in me. Boy, you can't get more connected than that, can you? And I in you. to know that I'm in the Father, you're in me, and I'm in you. He who has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me, and he who loves me shall be loved by my Father, and I will love him and will disclose myself to him. And verse 23, Yeshua answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he'll keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our abode with him. Connection. Chapter 15, verse 4, abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. Because he's taught that I'm the vine, you're the branches, right? Going down to verse 12. This is my commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. Chapter 16. Look at verse 25. These things I have spoken to you in figurative language. Now, Yeshua is speaking about speech itself. He's speaking about speech itself. What does he say? These things I have spoken to you in figurative language. An hour is coming when I will speak no more to you in figurative language, but will tell you plainly of the Father. In other words, words will need to be necessary. I'll speak to you in a spiritual way, in a deeper way. And then chapter 17 is the pinnacle of this entire dialogue of Yeshua is about connection. 17, look at verses 20 and 21. I do not ask on behalf of these. Yeshua is praying to his Father. I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, that the world may believe that you did send me. And verses 22 to 26 we'll end with. And the glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one, I and them, you and me, that they may be perfected in unity, that the world may know that you did send me and did love them even as you love me. Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, be with me where I am, in order that they may behold my glory which you have given me. For you did love me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, although the world has not known you, yet I have known you, and these have known that you did send me. And I have made your name known to them, and will make it known, that the love wherewith you loved me may be in them, and I in them. Look how he's using speech to describe this deep connection, this deep connection. There are so many other verses we can look at. I recommend you look up verses that have the word kiss in them. Verses that have the word neck. Verses that have the word voice or speech. And you're going to see some amazing truths come from the Word of God. But what we see here is Yeshua, the very Word of God, coming down to connect with people. And he comes down to bread of life, doesn't he? To feed us. He is the Word made flesh, so he is speech. He's also the bridegroom, and we're the bride. And I don't know too many newlyweds who don't start off their marriage with a big, fat, wet kiss. You know what I'm saying? And so we see this intimate connection on all these levels, physically, level of the soul, level of the spirit. And yet we see that we can break these if we want. We could be like Judas, who betrays him. We could be like Peter, who denies him. We can be like John, who stands firm and never leaves his side. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the truth that we've encountered this morning, and pray, Lord, that you would not allow us to lose them. But Father, you would keep them in our hearts and minds, that we'd ponder on these things, and you would continue to speak to us as you promised, clearly, not figuratively, but Lord, clearly, we can actually grasp what's in your mind without having even to try to put it into words. We thank you for your Spirit who has come to teach us all things, to lead us into all truth, and to comfort us. We thank you for him and pray that you continue to make us lights as your light. You continue to make us those who are sent out as you were sent. And as we have freely received, that we would freely give. And all things your glory might be reflected in our words and in our deeds. This is what we know you'll bring about in our lives because it's your